Hello and welcome back to PS Labor Talk. This week we're sitting down with, of course, Rick Torres, our CEO, a Permanent Solutions Labor Consultant. How are you doing today, Rick?
I'm doing good, James. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. We also have a regular on the show, Cliff Hammond, labor lawyer with Nemeth Burwell Attorneys. How are you doing today, Cliff?
Great, James. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. And we've also got Chuck Krugel, a human resources attorney and counselor, as well as a professional in labor and employment law, and a former director of employee relations for the YMCA, as well as a labor and employment attorney with the Airline Pilots Association. So quite a few decorated individuals with us here today. How are we all doing, gentlemen?
Pretty good, thanks.
Great. All right, so our topic today is micro unions and corporate campaigns. We're going to start out with corporate campaigns. Now, for those of us in the audience who are unfamiliar with exactly what corporate campaigns means, Cliff, can you go ahead and give us just a general idea of what that term actually denotes?
Sure. I mean, these aren't something new. There's nothing fundamentally different with corporate campaigns. It hasn't been going on for 35 years. What essentially happens is a union would like to come out and organize any way it can. And one of the ways you do that, obviously, is through going out the traditional route of having an election, through soliciting people to get cards, and then have more than 50% of the people say we want a union, file the petition. Another way to do that is to try to leverage companies that are so large, so big, maybe so difficult to get a hold of, that instead of going to get to the people, which might be difficult to do, you go after the company itself. And you go to the stakeholders, and the stakeholders are the people in the community that the company values as part of its structure. So you go to its customer base, you go to the base of the individuals who support it, and you attack that company in a bad light. You put money into advertisement. You go into the political sphere. You go to the shareholders. You go wherever it takes to put pressure and leverage on that company to capitulate, either one, to recognize the union without an election, or two, to say, you know what, we will simply recognize you as a union if you come up with enough cards. We won't even have to go through the whole process because we just don't want to fight anymore. We don't want bad publicity. We don't want a bunch of lawsuits against us on wage and hour issues. We don't want bad dirt coming out there because it hurts our company. So that's generally what a corporate campaign is. It's a way to air out dirty laundry against a company, to embarrass it or to pressure it, to capitulate to either one, recognition, or two, another easier format to get recognition.
You know, Cliff, one of the things as a national organizing director in the past, an ex-national organizing director, one of the things that we used to do was bring a lot of corporate campaign strategies into single facility organizing campaigns. But one of the things that's different between a regular campaign and what we call an official corporate campaign, first of all, it's the access to the money. I mean, it's high profile. Usually, what the unions want, and a lot of times it's multi unions also when they go after a corporation. But the ability for the campaign to have access to a lot of money. I mean, that's one of the things. If the international is involved in it, and it's a nationwide corporate campaign, or even a state or regional corporate campaign, you're going to have the state AFL-CIO, or, you know, it would change to when you're going to have their state offices involved, if not just on a state level, but on a national level also. So the influx of resources is going to be, tremendous.
I know one of the things that you see recently in the past was the Walmart. Obviously, unions have been going after that. When I say unions, I think you're really what you're saying, Rick, is you have multiple unions pooling their resources to go after one big target. And that's what it takes sometimes when you're going after a single facility of a certain size, or even if it's a national or regional, you have to pull sometimes from the national level enough resources to be able to counter against the resources that corporation has in the way that it's been embedded. And that's why the corporate campaign was created, wasn't it, Rick? I mean, that's one of the things you have to leverage against these big corporations financially.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, before the breakup with the AFL-CIO, when it went to change to win federation also, is when I was a, because I was a corporate campaign director also, what we used to do when we went on a large campaign, and whether it be, you know, statewide or multi-statewide or national, we used to, when we used to bring in the resources, you know, we used to cut it up. you know, whether it be within a state or within a nation. Somehow we used to bring it so everybody had, you know, a horse in the race. You know, we're going to, you know, have some skin in the game. We're going to break it up by region, or we're going to break it up by facility, by department. But everybody had to have the ability or a reason why they were going to put the resources into the campaign. So we would split it up and say, okay, let's bring our resources together. And it's more than just money, because you're looking at, you know, grassroots resources. You're looking at media. You're looking at all, you know, political, you know, even dealing with the religions, you know, with churches and priests or pastors. So there's a lot of resources, a lot of different resources we used to bring to the table. But once again, you know, it makes it much more viable once you bring in all the resources. And then you let the chips fall where they may.
One of the major components of the corporate campaign that's successful is one that does exactly what Rick says, from the outside, the union looking in, but from the company going out, is that you are a strong corporate citizen. A lot of companies want to portray this, and when there's the ability to put the resources in to somehow little by little chip away at your image, at your ability to be a good corporate citizen, it hurts, and you're willing to take chances. So there have been corporations that have been involved with this. What they've done is say, look, we're large. We can't take this hit politically. We can financially crush this over time, but it's going to hurt our image to the point where it's just not worth it. So we're willing to engage in an agreement that if the union's able to get 50% or more, 50 plus 1% of the people that work for us, the cards in this unit, ahead of time, we'll agree to do that. And we'll agree to an arbitration if things don't go right. And they think, you know what, we're so big, we're so large, it's just worth it. Let's cut the bleeding, stop this, and get into it. And what they find out is you've got the money and the resources to do the campaign already reserved. Now you just put the money into getting cards signed. And it's an easier switch. And so a lot of times what will happen is a company will back down. And they'll think, okay, we won the battle because we stopped that harassment. But it's still going. The resources were already set aside for this campaign.
Yeah, and I want to hear Chuck's view on this also, but
yeah.
you know, Chuck, one of the things that when I was doing corporate campaigns was that, and the same basic philosophy as organizing campaigns. I mean, the bottom line is just what you said, Cliff. But it's a brutal attack. It's a brutal attack. I mean, one of the things that we used to say is that we want to put you in a position where you have two options. And only two options. You continue to operate or exist with the union, or you don't continue to operate.
It's a war of attrition.
Absolutely.
One of the things they're seeing in Chicago, which has been really interesting relative to corporate campaigns, is Walmart and stores like Target, the other big box retailers, who've been opening up more stores in the suburbs than in the city. And really with Walmart, they were opening up on the fringes of Chicago, outside of the city, and therefore they were drawing away taxes from the city. So Walmart unions were working with a lot of churches and other religious organizations and some civil rights types groups or workers associations to really humiliate Walmart and some of these other big box retailers into, you know, having these stores outside of the city or not hiring city people and that type of stuff. And the irony was that eventually, some of these associations and the churches and these different groups, or political groups, civil rights groups, they had to do a 180 and actually practically beg Walmart to open up in the city because the constituents wanted these stores. They wanted the jobs. They wanted the stores. And eventually, now we have, like 6-7 different Walmarts in Chicago, and they're all over. They're in various neighborhoods. And all the uproar from this type of community organizing has died down, and it's all gone away, basically. One of the ironies is that none of these groups or associations, these churches, whatever, none of these people, none of these organizations employ people. It's Walmart and Target that employ people. So basically, these groups had to do a 180 and basically give up and say, you know, cry uncle, and say, yeah, you know, you guys are the ones who are employing people. Open up, please, you know, please open up in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, Chuck. I know that. In fact, I was just in California not too long ago in L.A., and I know that in a lot of the inner cities there, is just it's the exact opposite. It's just, you know, have the community groups are just outraged when they hear that a Walmart's coming in. And
it
I
used to be that way in Chicago, yeah. But it's not anymore.
It's absolutely like that here.
That's why it took so long for Walmart to open up in Chicago. I mean, I think its first store was in 2009, I believe, or thereabouts. And now they've started opening up more stores in mass numbers or mass quantities now in 2010, 11, 12, 13.
Now, Chuck, I have a question. I'd say Walmart's got to be the poster child for a resistance of corporate campaigns. I mean, how long have unions been after Walmart workers and with just very limited to pretty much no success? But we see evidence of the smear campaign against Walmart all the time. I mean, it's just absolutely prevalent. So why do you think now that the bridge is starting to give way? I mean, there are more Walmarts opening up. It seems like people in communities are starting to accept them. Think it's a result of the economy? Do you think that Walmart's actually won this war of attrition somehow?
I think it's the economy. People want jobs. And Walmart's employing them. Walmart's using some really clever strategies, including buying from local manufacturers or producers, like for different types of produce, meats and things like that. They're buying from local meat processing facilities, local gardens or local growers, things like that. Although I guess recently now there's some complaints that a lot of Walmarts aren't well stocked and that they're not staffed enough. So maybe there's a reversal. I'm not, you know, some sort of cyclical reversal going on with Walmart. But, you know, the way it's gone in Chicago is that they want them here. Everybody wants Walmarts here. And, you know, the groups have just kind of capitulated.
Well, you know, Rick's always saying when you talk to him that, you know, it's in your DNA. It's your corporate DNA. Whether or not your union or your employees continue to want to be part of the company, that's part of it too. I mean, Walmart has assessed and reassessed how it's going to brand itself and market itself. You've seen a resurgence of their brand through different marketing strategies. I think Chuck's right on with that. But I think more than anything else, it's a commitment to reassess who they are, where they're going to be, and how they're going to counter these things. I mean, weather the storm. Not every company is able to do that.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of these, what they're doing, as Chuck was just saying, you know, going more local and trying to get the community support, that is a result of the corporate campaign. You know, as far as the unions are concerned, they're not going to go away, because I think James stated it perfectly, that it's kind of the poster child. And they always want to have an enemy. You know, and it you know, Walmart's big enough though where it can take a lot of the attacks on it, but there's a lot of companies that can't. But even saying that, you know, Walmart is reacting to it by doing it, and it's a smart move. I agree with you, Chuck. It's a smart move. But
I think what you just said, Rick, about having an enemy is really important. Walmart doesn't really need an enemy. They have competition with Target or Costco or whatever, but the unions need an enemy. Unions don't provide jobs. They're not hiring anybody. They need the Walmarts and Costcos and everyone else to hire their members.
So yeah,
what else can they do but argue from the fringes that these places just, you know, suck?
Absolutely. Right. And we're like I said, and they're not backing down. And it's good to hear what's happening in Chicago, but nationwide, I see, you know, continuously. You know, in fact, if you look at the union websites, they're constantly talking about Walmart. They're going after them.
The Southeast, the corporate campaigns seem to be really revving up or big in the Southeast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one of the problems you see, and it's not just Walmart, but it's with the big box retailers wherever they go, is that there are city councils, there are commissions, there are county commissions. When they have to get approval for building, the corporate campaign is going to go after those people and target individuals there. And if they've been successful as far as Walmart at lobbying for the city of Chicago because constituents want the jobs, that may be unique to the condition of what was going on in the last 2 years in the economy overall.
Yeah.
But I do think, like Rick was saying, you know, across the country, what you're seeing is it's just difficult. And there used to be a, you know, saying, I think it's a lot of companies like that, it's difficult to beat that company when they want to come down and do something. But politically, that's where the corporate campaign goes. It's not just about putting out bad press. It's about getting people in the religious and political sector to back you and say, this X company is bad for business. That's a stakeholder. That's a stakeholder that's attacked, and I think that's where the unions want to go. And the success of them organizing is going to be, can they continue to do that? And I think that was one of the splits between the AFL-CIO and this change to win. Where do you put your money? And I think both of them thought that politics was one thing, but you know, effectiveness of your corporate campaign has to be pulling your resources and going after whatever state, local, national level political connections you want to leverage for these type of movements. Because if your big workforce is going to be moving with large change that are unorganized, and it puts out the smaller, maybe potentially organized facilities, that's bad for unions as well. So they're looking at that to target where they're going to go to. You can't win against Walmart. Well, who's the medium-sized competition you can win against?
Right. And you know, two things, Cliff, and you're spot on, is that, first of all, you know, with the, and you're right, the split, you know, between Sweeney and especially Stern, who really pushed the split with the AFL-CIO, and two gentlemen that I both know. But one of the things is that you know, how to, you know, looking at how to spend the money. Yeah, and they agree that even with Trumka, he agrees that money still has to be spent. But what they're doing now, instead of spending, where they want to target now, instead of spending on a national level so much, they want to start localizing it. And it's the same thing with corporate campaigns or mini corporate campaigns, because what we're seeing a trend of unions do now is start up, like I was reading, a few months back, where there was an organization that, I think it was in Louisiana somewhere, where it was saying, okay, let's start a local, you know, subsidiary union, and say just targeting all of the warehousing or all of, you know, so they're getting more specialized and trying to concentrate their efforts on maybe an industry or a large city or a region, to where they can make it more localized, instead of saying, okay, well, we're the same as everybody else in the nation. Well, no, because we're going to isolate it to this region, and it's about people in this region and workers in this region, for the same reason why they're doing the political stuff. You know, let's look and concentrate our money on the mayors and on the state senators and on the governors, you know, races. So
I think one of the places that you're seeing, one of the sectors that you see success in corporate campaigns in the last decade or so, has been in the healthcare industry, because even though they have resources, and a lot of large national healthcare organizations have resources as far as money and political clout, they also, to a certain extent, are what they are. They're healthcare organizations. They don't want a bad image. A negative image hurts them more than a retailer, because a retailer with good product prices is still a good product price. People are going to go there. But if you have a healthcare facility and people think of you being a bad guy, well, you have a choice between multiple places. Where are you going to go? And that's where the corporate campaigns have been successful, SEIU, versus associations, California Nurses Association, for instance. They've been successful because they've pulled their money and their resources, found a weak spot, and gone after there. And that, those have been the most successful that we've seen in the last decade, I would think.
Also, I think, Rick, what you're talking about before in terms of the unions going after more local, state, municipal-type campaigns, it's also reflective of our economy, where business is not itself a cohesive community anymore, where you have small businesses who have different views or different needs than larger businesses. So a company like Walmart is not necessarily in line with a smaller chain or like a medium-sized chain like Walgreens, or the even smaller chains that are, you know, the more local chains, or, you know, or grocery stores, things like that. So, you know, you have a much more diverse economy with much different interests, and I think some of the unions realize that nowadays, and
yeah,
they're going,
yeah,
they're, you know, just like the economy itself become fragmented, they're fragmenting more in terms of their campaigning and who they're going after. I think additionally, a company like Walmart or Target, as long as their stock value is higher, they're issuing dividends, or their shareholders are happy, they can afford to weather these types of storms with a lot more perseverance than a smaller privately held chain. So
No doubt about it. And also with the local strategy, it's, you know, and this is one of the complaints that we heard when I was working with unions, is that, well, you got people from California coming to Louisiana, you got people from, you know, from Georgia going out to Michigan. So it also makes it easier for them to keep it local. These are our people. These are, you know, people in our communities. These are, you know, so it's us talking to us. You know what I mean? The kind of strategy. And I think it's effective. And going back to what you were talking about, Cliff, on as far as healthcare, one of the things, in fact, we just put out an article on some healthcare organizing. What we used to call healthcare organizing, because they are so vulnerable, we used to call them soft targets, because it was they rely on public trust, they rely on their reputation, they rely on, you know, on the care that they give the patients. So it's almost like a community, you know. It's easier to organize because you can actually walk in there. You're not locked out. So it's much more of an open target, but it's also a soft target because their strengths, your patient care, how they deal with the community and everything, is also, you know, the weaknesses, especially when it comes down to like magnet status. You know, it's the excellent in nursing award that's very important to hospitals. And other health facilities also now, but that also is a weak point when unions have that soft spot, almost an underbelly where they can attack.
Yeah, I agree. I know one of the other things that's very interesting is a lot of employers know, like, we're moving into the social media age. A lot of your employees, especially the people that are just coming into the workforce, they're advanced in social media skills, email, the web. And one of the things that some of the large employers who are non-union successfully have been able to adapt to this media. I mean, if you take a look at the social media policy, NLRB has recently come down on a lot of big retailers about how their policies are too broad. The one policy that they found to be acceptable was Walmart's. And that just shows that if you are a employer and you really want to continue to have good relationships with your employees, have solid rules that make sense, you have to address them, be ahead of the game, and make sure that they're drafted. And that's one of the counters that you can have to a corporate campaign as well, because corporate campaign can go out to the shareholder or stakeholders, but also goes to the community. Who's getting access to information? And when you're able to legally put up rules that make sense and are enforceable, it makes you a harder target. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So, just to finish up on this, I'd like to ask you guys, what's your opinion on the trends here in these corporate campaigns? Are we seeing more of them now? You know, are we going to see a shift from the usual organizing campaigns, that bottom up approach that we were talking about earlier, from the workers to the top, or do you think the future of organizing will be this top down? You know, putting pressure outside of the company and eventually. I mean, it's essentially extortion is what it is. You're creating an environment that disables or inhibits the regular operating practices of a business until they just can't take it anymore. Now, to me, that seems like, one, more involved and more expensive for unions, which is going to be prohibitive. But at the same time, it's hard to combat. I mean, Walmart is an example of just... It stands out. You know what I mean? It's a company that it has a huge global brand and is going to be hard to take down, sure. But how can other companies like that stand up to these corporate campaigns?
Well, that's why it'll never go away. You know, the trend is what the trend's going to be. As the NLRB pendulum shifts back and forth about what's allowable and not permissive conduct, and that'll dictate what's going to happen to a certain extent, and as the resources of unions either dry up or get richer because of whatever rules, that's going to dictate it. But like we were talking about, there are different economics, there are different economies of scale. If you're going in after a small small group of employers, a corporate campaign to the degree that you're having with Walmart or a big box is going to make sense. Now you can get access to a traditional campaign. If you're talking about a mid-size, it may make sense, and I think that's what's been going on for the last 35 years.
Sure.
You try to refine exactly what it is you want to do. You set your targets. You set your priorities. If you think it's in your best interest to do a haymaker, you know, swing for the fences, not do cards, instead just go out there and try to embarrass the company into capitulating, then you'll do it. And I don't think that there's a way to say this is, you know, it's going away or that it's going to get more prevalent. I think it's going to, again, be who's the employer, what's the resources that we have, and what's our timetable.
Well, you mentioned the NLRB, and I actually wanted to bring that up too. You know, the board made up the rules and all the regulations for campaigns before these corporate campaigns came about. You know, they really started in the 70s and early 80s. So as of right now, we have this, and it's been around, like you've said, for for about 40 years now. Are we going to see regulations put into place? It doesn't seem to me like there have been any. You know, we really are talking about that war of attrition, and it really is extortion in some cases. We're talking about potential for libel, slander, and it's things like these that I just find it hard to believe there are legal alternatives for these companies, and it's also hard to believe that it's legal for the unions to conduct business in this manner.
It's hard to tell what the future is going to hold with the board, because it's such an animal politics, and the pendulum shifts too far. So you could say that rules will be set if there's somebody else in the office in 4 years and they really feel it's necessary to put some rules. They could clamp down hard. On the other hand, the current administration, if you take a look at the current appointees, they've basically said, you know what, picketing in certain circumstances has to be in a certain location for a certain time, but you can do something that looks a lot like picketing at a secondary place that isn't even involved with a labor problem, like called bannering, and sit there with a giant rat in front of a place that doesn't even have a union problem. And it puts pressure on not only the primary, but the secondary company. So now these rules, they change, and they can be onerous on people. And that's what people, I think, sometimes fail to understand, that it's not just about who's being organized. There are innocent victims in some of these campaigns that, even if they don't get organized, they're the victim of negative publicity.
Well, you know, Cliff, Chuck, I've always said, and this is one of the reasons when the Wall Street protests,
Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, Occupy Wall Street, movement was starting, and I question, and Occupy Wall Street has died down quite a bit, but there's going to be another movement, you know, and that's one of the things that we used to look at, not just nationwide, but globally, to try to catch, ride the wave of these populist movements. But I always said, well, how is, say, like an organization like Occupy Wall Street, say, for instance, there is labor problems and there is a strike. Well, what stops a group of concerned citizens or so-called concerned citizens from going and going to the clients or the customers of a company that's being struck, or there's problems with contract negotiations or organizing or whatever? What stops a organized group on their own, or so-called on their own, and we can all wink at that, from going and exercising the constitutional right by going and boycotting a customer of another company that's on strike? So you're talking about, labor laws when they have limits on how many people can be in front of a building. That's all labor law when it applies to the relationship between unions and the companies. But how does this apply, or does it apply, to outside organizations? So if and when another movement comes forward, it can change the way labor law is applied, or it can change the way that companies can be affected by some of these, by some of these situations that they find themselves in.
I think some of it's political too, though, because it depends on whether the politicians or the elected leaders want to permit, or what type of petitioning or protesting they're going to permit. I think that's some of the stuff we saw with the Occupy people in the various cities, where these mayors and county officials didn't want too much protesting or too out of protesting going on, especially during the summer months when tourism was increased, like in New York or in Chicago. So, and in Chicago, especially now, where we've been traditionally pro-labor and very Democrat, our Democratic leaders now are pretty much anti-labor.
Right. And I agree with you.
I think the rules and regulations, they'll go back to this. The start of it is, you think of the big three, one of the beginnings of the labor organization, not the beginning, but one of the biggest starts of labor in general was the big three when they got organized. No one remembers what the vote count was for that, because there was no vote. It was just a massive amount of protest, a massive amount of workers trying to take over, the unions and Walter Roots were taking over. And they did that. And then there were regulations to try to stop the type of actions they did. And so then you've got the regulations and rules that you really couldn't do most of the things that they did to organize those places.
Well, there was more violence back then, too.
much more violent. So that's been changed. So what do you do? Well, you set up the standards and rules we have today. The byproduct of the standards and rules that came out of the violence and the issues that came out there politically was the ability to then do a corporate campaign. If you shut down the corporate campaign, I do believe that there'll be some other social outcry that'll, just like Rick said, and you've got the Occupy whatever city, and you go out there, not, and if it's not Occupy, there's always going to be someone who's going to find a way to try to get the message across. I don't think you're going to nullify it. Just what politically are we willing to take? We're not willing to take the violence? No. If we're willing to take the protest? No. So it's always going to be there. There's this undercurrent that's always there.
Well, you know, Cliff, I was reading an article, and it's been said in many, many different ways, and I was reading an article today in preparation for our conversation, and it quoted one gentleman from the SEIU who was talking about corporate campaigns, in fact, and he was saying, well, you know, we like good conversation, but we love conflict, you know, and they're always going to find a way, and once again, and on Chuck's point, as far as, you know, what, you know, the political aspect of it and how they can limit stuff. They can limit activity, but they can't stop it. Right now, there's no secondary boycott with the NLRB that a union can apply to the customers of someone that they're striking. With a independent group or so-called independent group, there is no limit on that. They may be able to limit, you know, how many people are standing in front of a building, but they can't limit or stop the boycott. You know, and that's
also America itself was built on protest.
Yeah,
and the idea that people can protest.
Right.
I think part of the problem with the labor unions now, you know, from the 70s on going forward, is that they're seen as part of the establishment, and they're seen as being corrupt politicians unto themselves almost because of the way they manage their pensions and how little of actual representation they do. So, yeah, I just think a lot of people just see them as the same as the establishment.
That's a good point, because that's why unions have tried to rebrand themselves significantly in the last 10 years. I mean, look at the number of newly named branches that have come out of every single union.
Yeah.
You look at the SEIU and how they've tried to say, well, we're not SEIU that you know. We're now the, you know, the nurses brand, or we're this worker. You look at the UAW, the Teamsters, the Change the Wind Coalition. Everybody's trying to rebrand themselves because they don't want to be part of what people think is the old guard, the bad part.
Well, for years,
so many unions were sexist and racist, and, you know, now they've had to rebrand themselves as being, you know, very inclusive. So,
well, absolutely, but I also want everybody to remember also, and you're right, but you know, I'm going to take the position that even in a campaign in a single facility, and when the union gets in there, especially in a corporate campaign, even card check, there's no, you know, unless it's an agreement with the company, there's no limit for the time that a company can be in there before they're even discovered that they're in there, and that's why they need to stay under the table, and they need to really start agitating and getting people frustrated. Because even when you're talking about local issues, even when you're talking about brothers and sisters or wives or husbands, you know, who are on the opposite side of an organizing drive or a strike or a labor dispute, any type of labor dispute, you know, but the emotions cloud all of that, you know, because once again, we can talk about all the specifics, and we can talk about all the downside and what unions are. But once you get into a heated battle, and that was my job for many years, is to get people heated up and angry and frustrated. And that's how we want to organize in campaigns. But once you get into the heat of the battle, when lines are drawn, you know, it all goes out the window. You know, it all goes out the window. If you can get them to that point, it all goes out. Everything else goes out the window because they're just focused on, you know, winning, their team winning.
So I want to we've gone over corporate campaigns quite a bit, and it looks like the situation is honestly pretty dire for the people that are that stand up to these things. What kind of advice could you give to employers? What do they have to do to insulate themselves against such a comprehensive and, like Rick just said, stealthy campaign?
Well, first of all, I don't know if it's that dire
for the private sector businesses, like the smaller to medium-sized businesses. I mean, it's troubling, and if you have a giant rat, you know, inflated in front of your place, it could be, you know, troubling at first. I always tell clients, you know, sometimes the kids love those things, so, you know, don't get too scared initially. But, you know, I think it's really just repetitive, and I think what Cliff was alluding to earlier, that this isn't going on for years, it's just more of the same. And the fact of the matter is, statistically, their unions are still worse and getting and continually being worse off in the private sector. So they're still losing numbers in the private sector. The only place they're really gaining seems to be in some areas of not-for-profit and the public sector. So I think your private sector business, you know, the reality is if you persevere and don't lose your head about it, you'll be okay.
Well, I would say that there is some truth to that, that you, if you have patience, if you have a plan, you have strategy, you can weather the storm. But the problem that a lot of places have fallen into, the mid-sized, the small employers, is they panic.
Yeah.
Don't understand. They do have time, and they should be prepared beforehand, but they need to get themselves aligned. Don't panic.
Definitely.
That's the key.
And I think the rule of thumb is the same thing is every organizing campaign or any situation. If you conduct business professionally, have basic respect for your people, and listen to what they have to say. I think that is the best. I mean, it's not complicated staying union free. You just have to make, and I'm going to say what you stated earlier, Cliff, is make staying union free part of your corporate DNA and treat people with respect, with dignity, and consistently.
Yeah, and whenever I deal with a client with the NLRB, and typically these agencies, whether it's the NLRB or the EEOC, usually their modus operandi is always the same. When you start out with their investigators, you're the worst employer in the world. You're the worst person in the world. And then when you get up to dealing with their attorneys, it's a 180. And it's like, what can we do to resolve this situation?
Yeah, I think that is part of the situation. But unfortunately for a lot of small and medium-sized employers on thin margins, they can't handle a long-term corporate campaign if they think it's going to be effective, cost them money, cost them customers. So in order to avoid that, they've got to be able to have good relationship with their stakeholders. They've got to make sure that they can weather the storm, not just from their customers who are good to them because they treat them well, but from their employees because they're not going to bite in, so they treat them well. But they continue to foster good relationships in the community.
Yeah.
So that if something like that happens, people don't just latch on and go, well, I don't know who you are. They're saying you're a bad guy. I think you are a bad guy. If they say, no, I don't know who this group is that's making these statements, but I do know that company, and I know that they make sense, and I know that they're good people because I deal with them, and they're good corporate citizens. I think that goes a long way, too.
Well, definitely. You know, it is the old 101 political campaign kind of strategy is don't let your opponent define you. You have to continuously be defining your company, how you operate, in a positive light, and not let the union come in, even if they're in there for a year, to do it. The problem is that a lot of companies don't have that foresight, and they're more concerned on a day-to-day basis with just operating stuff and really don't have a tight look on how, you know, the frontline supervisors are treating their people, and that's where it all goes awry.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about micro-unions here. This has especially become prevalent in the healthcare organizations. For audience members who aren't entirely familiar with the term, could you actually go over what a micro-union is for us?
Yeah, this is basically something that the National Labor Relations Board has created where a union, if they don't have a majority of the employees at a business, or a majority of the classification of employees, like all the manufacturing employees aren't in support of the union, then they can maybe go to different divisions within the manufacturers, different sectors of them, and carve out exceptions. So in the healthcare industry, I believe they've been doing it among like maybe nurses or different sort of healthcare staffers who interact with customers as opposed to those who don't interact with customers. And it's also merged over into the retail industry, like with Bergdorf Goodman in New York City, where they micro-unionized, and this starts to get really confusing because it's it's just all over the place with the NLRB, but they micro-unionized some salespeople, but not all salespeople. So, you know, in different departments.
I believe Chuck was on the second and the fifth floor that they organized the salespeople, you know?
That's what I was just going to say, that literally it was like the second and fifth floors of governor unionized, and then the other floors weren't.
So do you think then the
departments are those second and fifth floors?
Do you think then the goals of the micro unions are to branch out, you know, grab a foothold in whatever way they can, and then essentially move out through the rest of the company? And on top of that, are these actually? I mean, the term is a little misleading. I think a micro union, are they independent? You know, are those workers on the second and fifth floor running every level of that union, or are they sponsored by, you know, like a retail workers union or the SEIU in the case of a health employer?
It varies. It's because you can end up having 10 different unions on a floor or within a shop. And it's hard to say. I think, in my opinion, this is very much like the social media policies that the National Labor Relations Board, you know, they've been issuing these decisions on. They're just all over the place, and they're kind of making up as they go along. And that, to me,
I would agree with that.
That's the simple
way to
put it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, and it's easier, the smaller the unit, the more cohesive is the unit. You know, a group of workers, and, you know, in fact, a majority of the union wins are small unions, units. So it makes it a lot easier to you know, win the campaign because you have a tight-knit group who you're organizing. And as Chuck just stated, it could be, you know, just tremendously complicated and costly for a company, because you could have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and more unions within your facility and have to negotiate.
You have 10 bargaining agreements.
You'd be negotiating nonstop.
You have different payrolls, and you have to have different payroll processors. You have to pay. I mean, the overhead for small to medium-sized business can be astronomical.
Not to mention, you've got competition then between the different unions. You've got one, you know, you might have employees on one floor telling about the union advantages that their micro union has. All of a sudden, the fifth floor is upset because their healthcare premium's higher. So now you've got an entirely, I mean, you're looking at 10 different people that you've got to bring to the table and make everyone happy.
Well, not only that, James, is that what this could actually do, if this really shoots out, that a company that is being approached with a micro unit might say to themselves, or might say, you know, maybe we ought to give card check, because
it's going to be way easier to deal with one unified union in the plant,
yeah,
or wherever.
Because like Chuck just said, it could be confusing. It could be nonstop litigation. It can just destroy a company.
All of a sudden, it's not a choice between no union and a union. It's a choice between how many unions do I want. And essentially, they've already won at that point, because you've narrowed down all the options to unionization.
I think that's the goal, though. The goal is to get people organized, and that's what you see. This micro-union issue is nothing but a disregard for business.
Yeah.
It takes very little common sense to understand that the people who are behind these type of decisions do not care whether a corporation succeeds economically.
They're
only about it politically. And that's what this is about. This is about, we have a motive. We have a social agenda. We favor organizing, and we don't care about the business. If the business fails, it's their problem. They need to go ahead and just get rid of this whole barrier that the workers organize under this union and negotiated contract.
And it keeps the NLRB going. I mean, this is just another purpose for the existence of the NLRB. They've gone into social media issues involving non-union companies, and they've seen what it's done for them in that realm, and now they're getting, you know, the micro-unions is sort of the same thing. This gives them a reason to exist.
Right. The more bureaucracy, the longer that the NLRB stays in relevance.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, it's, you know, I was reading the briefs and the decisions on the Bergdorf-Goodman case, and it was pretty interesting because they were talking about the community of interest doctrines and the different doctrine that came out of the healthcare case, and then all these community of interest doctrines dating back to decisions from the 40s with the NLRB. But the one thing that they didn't do, and I thought was kind of interesting, was they never talked about the economic reality in terms of dollars and cents. So what would it cost Bergdorf-Goodman, you know, to actually divvy up their employees among these different divisions in terms of the overhead? And because that's something
I've always found to be sort of useful with unions nowadays is opening up the books to them and showing them how much all this stuff costs the company, whether it's the pension, the benefits, or, you know, different aspects of the benefits, things like that.
Right, and I mean,
that's not reality to those people who are on the other side. The cost of the company is irrelevant. As long as the company survives, it can cut something else. That's the NLRB, though, I think. I think to some union people, I mean, it's been, to the attorneys I've dealt with on the union side, it's been revelatory for them because they realize that if we're willing to, you know, if we're willing to walk the walk as well as talk the talk, that we'll, you know, we'll show them everything. We'll open the books up and show them, you know, what's going on with the business. And it's hard for them to dispute that without looking completely inhuman about it.
Well, I think you make a good point, though, is that there are times when you sit down with the unions and you show them the books and say, this is reality. This is bedrock. And for the most part, especially at the higher level, when you get to the negotiations, the emotions are gone. They go, you know what? I get it. We got to do something. But when you get into a bureaucratic setting like the NLRB, you can look pure esoteric and just say, I don't care. And that's what you see with the micro unit. The micro unit issue is, we don't care about reality. This is a philosophical difference. We are not winning in the private sector. There's got to be a better way.
Right.
And that's exactly the point.
And, you know, Cliff, it's not only that. It's different when you're dealing with, when you have a relationship with a company, not always, you know, but when you have a relationship with a company and they open their books to you and you see what's going on, then it's a little different. When you're dealing with organizing campaigns, it's in fact, even in contract negotiations, because I've negotiated a lot of contracts and on strikes and where we deliberately went out to destroy the companies. You know, it was just at that point because, you know, legally we lost a strike, so, you know, let's scorch earth. But in organizing campaigns, it's a little different because your only goal is to win the campaign, and by any means necessary, and if it means that the company goes out of business because of whatever reason, because they can't afford it, because they spend so much money, because it hurt their business, whatever, the union, when I was an organizing director, that wasn't my concern. My concern was to win, and I'd rather a company go out of business rather than lose the campaign. You know, so it gets really mean-spirited. It gets really destructive. And so, it, once again, you're dealing with the emotions. So it's very divisive.
No, I agree with you. You know, my experience when I was with the union was the same, and I think, unfortunately, that's the problem with the current constituted board, is that it's constantly in that level of, we have one goal only. We're not here to look at all factors. And if you take a look at the briefs, which I've done too, there is just no rational way to look at all the factors. They ignore the economic reality. It's just, for someone who understands the reality of business and what is going on with labor and the economy, to read the briefs and the rationalizations, it's like, what's missing here? I think Chuck, you know, hit it right there. They just don't, they don't even look at it. It's not a factor. It's unconscionable almost to look at these things and not even put that into the equation.
The board themselves won't look at the numbers, but my experience has been that sometimes you get good union attorneys or good union officials who will. Generally, the union officials themselves, the representatives, they won't. But so every once in a while, maybe, you know, 10% of the time, you'll find a good one who will. But more, I found that a higher percentage of the union attorneys will be more rational and look at the numbers, especially when their members, if they've been fired or lost their jobs or lost benefits, are sitting there realizing that, hey, they don't get a, the union doesn't get a damn about the fact that I'm not working, or I have no money coming in, or my kids are in the hospital without insurance.
Right, because there is a breaking point when a company just can't afford to make the concessions, and especially in this economy, that the unions are demanding. And eventually, those are going to be felt by the union membership. And I think you have a good point. They're going to apply some pressure to their representatives if that's the case.
Well, and the idea of micro unions is workplace democracy. And if the National Labor Relations Board is really in favor of workplace democracy, then they have to go to the workers themselves and say, what do you guys want? Now, more often than not, I don't think they do that. But at some time, you know, in some disputes I've been involved in, you basically have to force their hand to do that, by escalating it to the day of trial, so to the point that, you know, you're literally at the day of trial, a half hour from the
from the ALJ, the administrative law judge, starting a trial, and then finally some voice of rationale from the other side says, hey, maybe we could really work this out.
Well, I can tell you that all that is true, but what I've seen in my experience is what employers have to understand is if you have an attorney who makes sense the day of the trial, it's fine, but I've seen labor side attorneys who have become administrative law judges, and when you get in front of that, you have the political plus the labor-sided person who has both political ambition, they've been put there for a reason, they will not allow you to enter into the discussion at that point in time about economic realities or how that might apply. It is a strict rule, you know, construction on the part of the employees, and it is a problem, and that's what's going on at the NLRB. At the highest level, you have politically charged decisions that are going on, and that's what employers have been.
Are you talking about in terms of evidence, like entering into the record, that type of evidence, or are you talking about even?
I'll give you an example. I went to an administrative law hearing recently, and it was regarding layoffs, and what the administrative law judge indicated there was, I'm not inclined to let economics come in other than for documentary purposes, which basically means I don't want to hear your reasons why you laid people off. Well, we're not going to hear reasons why we're laying people off. It kind of is a problem since the contract says you can lay off for the following purposes. One of them was for economics. And it was a politically charged because what it ultimately came down was an interest decision. Was it because, you know, politically it was the right thing to do? Was it politically motivated? Could you have cut something else on a higher level? Could you have cut somebody else? And what the union wanted to do was say, well, you know, there's top-end managers making too much money. You should have cut that, and you shouldn't have taken it off the back of the working people. And it almost became this, well, you're allowing us to put it in, but only in a certain manner.
Yeah.
And what you see as these type of individuals on the labor side that are politically motivated, that truly are believers in the true, you know, hardcore socialist movement, is that economics mean nothing because economics are all cookbooks, in their opinion.
Yeah, I think, though, when you try to put it into the record, the actual evidentiary record, you're right. They're more often than not, they're not going to allow it. But when you're behind closed doors talking about a settlement and then saying to the other attorney or saying to the ALJ or to the union rep, hey, go ask your members what they think of this. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I've done this with the tax records and everything. Of course, you know, they're always going to complain that the records are cooked, that the books are cooked. But, you know, fine, then go tell the IRS. Don't lie to me about that. Lie to the IRS. You know, this is the best records we have, and let's deal with what we got, you know, what we have here. And more often than not, if they want to go through a trial, and, you know, and obviously prior to that, they're also threatening with a temporary restraining order or some sort of injunction, and then you're making the same sort of argument to the board, you know, to the regional office or Washington, D.C. regarding that. So you get some sort of indication from them if they're not going to pursue a TRO or injunction, that kind of victory, a small victory into itself. But, you know, you sort of get some inclination from them where they're going with this, and you get an idea, especially if you're talking to the ALJ about what you can or can't enter into the record and what they will talk about behind closed doors and settlement, where this all could go.
And everything you and I have been saying is great for companies that have the resources to fight those fights and get to the day of trial. The problem really comes to, you've got 100 employees and you're marginally successful, and you got unionized, and let's just say you have a micro unit of 10 of your 100 employees, and all of a sudden you're coming down and you're going to open the books up for those guys, and everybody else is looking at your books, and you really don't want people to see your books. I mean, the problem comes down to, if you have established clients, you know, that have been in union business, and there's no problem with doing it, it's fine, but it's embarrassing to open up your books sometimes. Number two, it's just something that a lot of companies that I've dealt with say, I don't want people to know what my vice president makes. I just out of principle. And it becomes difficult to do that if you have, you know, a client that's willing to do it, it's great. You can bring it to the union. If you have a client that says no, and if you don't have the resources to fight the fight, these are the leverage points that they utilize. They can use this and any other tactic too. But, you know, a lot of clients just aren't afraid and say, you know what, my numbers are my numbers, and it is what it is, and I don't care.
Yeah, and it's something I hate to see with clients when they, you know, kind of, when they give up, and I'm saying, stick with it, just stick with it, we'll be okay. And then, you know, they have other issues going on. Even, I had a client once who's going through a bad divorce, and we were dealing with the NLRB, and finally he just said, you know, just settle for whatever we can get, and, you know, let's just wrap this up. I got my divorce to deal with.
Right.
Right, I think a lot of the time, because we're dealing on such large scales, we forget that everyone involved is our people, you know, and I think that's one of the biggest failings that in the way that unions have operated and the way that they've evolved is they've really just become unions for the sake of continuing the existence of being unions.
They're managing their pension fund.
Right, yeah, they want more dues-paying members, and it's not about anymore, and you see this because of the micro-unions, and you see it because of the corporate campaigns. You know, when you're promoting worker rights and worker compensation, fairness across the workplace, it shouldn't be about, it's not a PR, you know, campaign against companies. It shouldn't be about turning suppliers against their business partners, turning shareholders against management. That doesn't benefit the employees at all. It just creates a political divisiveness. And
it's supposed to be about workplace democracy, and
sure.
Really, it becomes really anti-democratic, especially when you start looking at the union's numbers, their finances themselves, and look at their pension funds and see how many, you know, millions or billions of, some of them literally billions of dollars that they've lost after 2000, from 2008 on.
Well, you know, and the thing about it is you know, and coming from my background many years, and I will tell you this, that it is not on a national level. It is not about what's best for the members. It's what's best for the institution, and this is something that I know Cliff's heard me say this a few times. We used to like democracy, just we didn't like too much democracy, you know, and on a national level, we were never concerned. We were concerned with numbers. We were concerned with progress. We were concerned with dues. We were never concerned about, well, how many people got suspended, how many people got fired. So it was never an issue to us on a national level, you know, as far as, you know, the things that we believe in, you know, that should be happening in the workplace, you know, especially if someone is representing and taking dues money from their members, then it should be all about those members. But in reality, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I represent clients whose employees don't even want to be members of the union themselves, but the company wants to be a member of the union because that's the only way they could get union-related business and public sector projects or whatever. So here you have basically the union versus everybody except for the owner of the company, and even the owner of the company is just doing it because it's a necessary evil that they have to sign a contract with them and they have to force their own employees to pay union dues.
So yeah, essentially,
pro-union and pro-labor aren't always the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So essentially what we're looking at now, I just want to give a recap here for everybody, is that under the current political climate and under the current conditions, especially related to the NLRB and the current administration, I don't think we're going to see anything but a rise in micro unions. I think we're going to see a lot of development in that field. I think we're also going to see micro unions expanding into companies and outside of that healthcare. You know, we talk about this all the time, Rick and I and Cliff. You've got to make it part of your corporate DNA then to promote not only a sense of workplace unity, but a loyalty to your employer and an idea that if you have a problem with your workplace, your manager is going to help you out with that instead of trying to seek some third party to do so.
Democratization without unionization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everyone, so much for stopping by today. I really appreciate the conversation. Once again, today we had Cliff Hammond, our regular guest on the show here from Nemeth Burwell. And also Chuck Krugel, and of course, Rick, our CEO of Permanent Solutions Labor Consultants. Thanks a lot, guys. I hope you all have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Thanks.
Thank you.